You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 5th of March 2018 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Muller on today's show. Not for the first time in recent memory, the citizens of a prosperous first world country throw an immense tantrum, almost certain to make themselves worse off. Italy's election goes about as badly as might have been feared. My guests Quentin Peel and Brian Klass will be discussing this and the day's other top stories, including Germany's painstaking assembly of a new governing coalition, how seriously the world should be taking Donald Trump's latest big idea, and citizens of one European country vote against lightening their own tax burden. That's all coming up on Midori House on Monocle 24 right now. And you are welcome to Midori House. My guests today are Quentin Peel, Associate Fellow with the Europe Programme at Chatham House, and Brian Klass, Fellow in Comparative Politics at the LSE. Welcome both. And we start tonight in Italy. Yesterday, the people spoke in a general election. Today has begun the complicated task of deciphering exactly what they said. For fans of unobtrusive, pragmatic government steered by a steady hand on the tiller, it all looks somewhat unpromising. The options appear to be a government dominated by faintly unsavoury far-right headbangers, or by mildly cranky anti-establishment grandstanders. Italy's tradition of governments collapsing before they've even worked out how to get an outside line is looking a feature rather than a bug at this point. Quentin, let's start by attempting optimism. What's the least terrible imaginable outcome here?
Probably some sort of almost left-right coalition. That was, in a way, what we were expecting, that they'd come out with a grand coalition a bit like Germany. The truth is that a grand coalition just of the centre-left, the PDs who are losing power, and Forza Italia, Berlusconi, say, just don't have the numbers. So then you suddenly come up with, hey, well, what about a government headed by the five-star movement, the sort of the rebellion? They're the biggest party.
They are the biggest party by quite some margin, in fact.
So they've got to find a partner. Now, up to now, they've been saying, we don't want to govern with anybody. But suddenly, they're saying, no, I mean, we will govern in the interests of the country. But it's not at all obvious who of the others might be their favoured partner.
Brian, is the best that can be hoped that we do end up with a coalition of yahoos that prove so completely incapable of actually doing anything like governing that the fact of them being in government doesn't really make any difference?
Well, I think that's optimistic.
On the American model, for example.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I mean, there is sort of this idea, right, that there's this, you can end up having a vaccine with authoritarian populism or sort of anti-globalism populism, etc., where it's so dysfunctional and chaotic that at the end of the day, the voters go back to the sort of functional centrist view. Now, I don't know if that's the ideal outcome. I think the ideal outcome is making sure that these people don't end up in power because they can do a lot of damage in the meantime. And I think it's worth pointing out that the head of the Five Star Movement, was very recently, before his entry into politics, a steward at a football stadium. His political career is basically his career. He has not done anything really else, and he didn't graduate from university. I think there's, a sort of coalition that needs to form that says we need people who understand how the system works. We have a major global shift in how power is concentrated and how that power is being rebuked by anti-globalist figures, etc. But if you're going to dismantle the system, you better understand what could come next. And I'm afraid that with the Italian elections, we could be drifting towards a situation where people who do not understand the system at all are going to dismantle it with extremely serious consequences.
Quentin, is this a specifically Italian thing that would have been happening anyway? Or do you see this as part of a phenomenon which we are seeing around the world? And it is, on the face of it, perplexing. These are citizens of certainly presently globally fortunate and functional and prosperous countries. Historically, they are among the most fortunate human beings who have ever lived. You know, any citizen of Italy who voted for Five Star, any citizen of Germany who voted for the AFD, any citizen of the United States who voted for Trump. And yet, they keep wanting to kick the table over.
Well, I think there's a lot of insecurity around, and people are just generally angry. They are, as you say, wanting to get the table over. They feel uncertain about immigration. It's obviously a huge issue. It's been a very big issue in Italy. It was a big issue here in Britain over Brexit. And indeed, it was an issue in Germany. So that's one that worries them all. And I think that we've underestimated the effect on an awful lot of people of that global financial crash in 2008-2010. You know, that hit a lot of people and it made a lot of people uncertain. So it's uncertainty driving this. Now, there's an anti-elite factor as well. And I think there's an element of that which is maybe fueled by this explosion of activity and information on social media, on the internet. This is suddenly everybody is, if you like, naked. You know, they're suddenly exposed. Are they on the take? Now, if you add to that general backlash the specific Italian features of this. I mean, Italian politics has been rather corrupt for a very long time. And look what happened here. This was a rebellion particularly against the two old centre-left, centre-right parties. They've been in power too long. So we thought Berlusconi might even come back with this, but actually he's not done very well at all. His party only got 14%.
Well, he hasn't gone away entirely, unfortunately, and Berlusconi being Berlusconi, it seems unlikely that he will. Brian, did this election strike you like those other elections that Quentin mentioned, as basically a referendum on immigration, once you shear everything else away? Is that what was going on here?
Yeah, so I think that we have to have a new paradigm that looks at voting as a clash between those who want more open societies and those who want more closed societies. I think that there's been a longstanding consensus that has been proved wrong, that is, in capitalist democracies, the major divide is between left and right based on class interests. And what we're seeing in a huge variety of elections is that identity, immigration, openness to the world, globalization, those are fault lines that cut across class, they cut across generations, and they end up creating strange bedfellows. And you have, this is why in the United States, for example, you could have people who would simultaneously consider voting for Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump, right? Which on economic policy are very different. And so I think we have to think about this as how it reshapes our politics. And also, people who believe in liberal democracy need to think about how they can send the message to those voters that they stand with their values in a broader sense, even if they are supporting the status quo and the establishment. Because ultimately, if it's just a sort of tear everything down mentality that ripples across Europe and the Western world, we're in for decades, not years, of serious dysfunction in our democracies.
Quentin, the Italian newspapers have been other than overjoyed in their editorials this morning. La Stampa says Italy is ungovernable. Libero says a chaotic government of amateurs. Are either of those assessments wrong?
No, I don't think they are. There was another one I seem to remember that says Italy is a brothel. So I think that they are really shaken by this. But what behind this is an incredibly difficult social divide that we're seeing. Our societies are divided very equally. Now, if you look at this in terms of pro and anti-Europe, for example, 50% of the Italian electorate has just voted for essentially Eurosceptic parties. That's almost exactly the same as in France and in Britain, that we split right down the middle. And forming a government when you've got this incredibly difficult divide, add to that in Italy this very clear north-south divide. So the Lega Nord that's come in, the Lega, anti-immigration and very resentful of southern Italy's corruption, if you like, whereas the Five Star Movement did very well in southern Italy and picked up most of the seats.
Well, let's now move seamlessly along from a European country about to embark on a protracted, painful and tedious exercise in coalition building to a European country which has just concluded one. Germany, which had an election 6 months, or several of the average Italian governments ago, now has a government of its own, a revival of the so-called Grand Coalition between Angela Merkel's Christian Democratic Union and the Social Democrats. Brian, this sees Chancellor Merkel embarking on her fourth term, but does she, so it does sound, put like that, slightly fatuous to describe her as a weakened leader, but is she?
I actually think the opposite. I think she's in a stronger position because everybody sort of with Merkel tends to send the, you know, say that this is the final straw. She's now weak and she's now on the ropes. And inevitably, she manages not to be. And I think the reason why she's empowered is because she has made signals that she is in her final terms. This is her last chance. And in some ways, this grand coalition being overwhelmingly approved, you know, will end up freeing her to be more herself. And so I think that the political constraints will be off. She'll be able to be a more pragmatic, consensus-building leader. And I think as a result of that, the sort of continued and often premature, you know, discussions of her political demise are again premature.
Quentin, Brian raises an interesting paradox there, that the idea that an unshackled, unfettered Angela Merkel will see herself as free to become more pragmatic.
Yeah, I mean, Brian's absolutely right. I mean, she, in this government, she is the strongest figure. I mean, she has got this remarkably high popularity in Germany. It's come down a bit, I think, but it's around 48%. That's very high for a serving politician who's done three terms now as Chancellor. And whereas the Social Democrats in her government are much more weakened than she was, and also her junior partner, the CSU from Bavaria, is also looking pretty rocky. So she's in a much more confident position. Now, she does have this new arrival on the German scene, the alternative for Germany, the anti-immigration right-wing party, Eurosceptic, with more than 90 seats in the German parliament. And they are going to be the lead voice in the opposition now, which is going to be quite difficult to deal with. So that's one of her problems. And the other problem is that everybody is pretty convinced she's not going to do another term. This is the last.
But just to follow that up, Quentin, does it seem to you that she will see her primary role in her fourth and possibly final term as essentially, I don't know if negative's the right word, but as a basically holding the line? I mean, it's important, is it not, for the EU and the entire Western Hemisphere at this point that Germany and France at least do not go full Yahoo?
I'm torn on this one. I think that she may very well want to leave a rather clear, if you like, European footprint on her final term in office. And she sees Emmanuel Macron in France as the partner with whom she can do that. She didn't get on well with François Hollande. She didn't get on well with Nicolas Sarkozy. She has a man in Emmanuel Hollande in France who she can do business with. Now, can she actually get a really quite reformist programme for Europe on the Eurozone, on more defence and security, on an asylum agreement for all the countries of the European Union? It's a very big challenge, but I have a feeling that is what she wants to do, rather against her natural inclination, which is just to sit and wait and sort out problems.
Brian, as Quentin points out, she does face a, well, if not a threat, then a difficulty she hasn't had before, which is Alternative for Deutschland, who got 12.6% back in September of the vote and do have those 90-odd MPs in the Bundestag. What can or should she do, I guess, to ensure that her successor, as we assume, doesn't face that kind of result following the next election in Germany? How has the West actually figured out yet how to marginalise or let the air out of populist insurgencies?
So I think there's two problems here that she has to deal with. One is that no matter what, now the AfD is going to be mainstreamed, and it's going to be in the discourse in virtually every story because it is the main opposition party. So that means that their narrative will be the counter-narrative to the government. Now, that cuts both ways. On the one hand, that means that a lot of Germans are going to hear from the AfD for the foreseeable future. On the other hand, because there's a grand coalition, if she can build consensus around a variety of policies, she can end up showing that there's a real German consensus against the AfD. And that could be a very powerful message, one that doesn't exist in a lot of polarized countries where there are no grand coalitions, where the sort of battling back and forth between left and right allows populist insurgencies to sort of say the whole lot is rotten and we're going to, you know, be an alternative to them. I think if there's genuine consensus building in German government going forward, it could be helpful. I also think one thing we have to keep in mind is that, you know, four terms for Merkel is not necessarily the most healthy thing for a democracy. And it may be good that there's revitalization, that there is a different leader coming around, and that Merkel has to think about that legacy and what comes next. That might actually cause her to govern more effectively and in ways that do build consensus.
What do you think, just a final thought on this, Quentin, is the approach she will take to the AfD? Because we've seen various attempts in recent years in Western democracies to deal with populist insurgencies. And I guess if you have at one end of the spectrum the idea of taking their concerns, in inverted commas, seriously and trying to accommodate what they're worried about and move the Overton window in their direction, and at the other end you just write them off as a marginal sack of rancorous dingbats, where in between those two do you think Merkel might pitch it?
Her instinct is very hostile. During the election campaign, we saw her a couple of times when she was being yelled at by supporters of the AfD from the crowd. She just totally ignored them. She treated them with contempt. Now, I think she may have to learn to go a bit beyond that. The thing is that Merkel is a peculiar creature, but she's a really a social democrat dressed up in Christian Democrat clothes. She's slightly left of centre, if anything, which is why she likes governing in a grand coalition. There's a lot of people in her own party to the right of her who would be, if you like, her protection, her reassurance that the AfD won't pick up votes. And that includes the Bavarians, the most conservative wing of this alliance. And she's got to try and encourage them, I think. She's done one very interesting thing. She's brought into the government, to the heart of her government, as health minister, Jens Spahn. He represents the right wing of the party. He's a young man, 38 years old. He's gay, which gives him a sort of cover to be quite right wing, so he can say he's modern and right wing, if you like. And he's a possible successor. So that may be one way in which she tries to protect herself and her party from this peeling away to the right.
Just a final quick codicil to that question, though, Quentin. When confronting the AfD, obviously in the context specifically of Germany, does she dare play the warning from history card?
It's something that every German child has been brought up with, you know. I mean, this is very deep in Germany to say we mustn't go back there, which is why the AfD has always been pretty scared at being labelled neo-Nazi. And so they have to watch out for that as well. Every seriously neo-Nazi movement in Germany that's popped out of the woodwork over the last five, six decades has shrunk again and shriveled and vanished. So I think that if the AfD flirt with hard-line nationalistic anti-foreigner policies to anything beyond a rhetorical degree, they could be in trouble.
Okay, we're going to take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House with me, Andrew Muller, along with Quentin Peel and Brian Klass. Coming up next, Trump's latest big idea.
Monocle's stately March installment comes with a decided South Korean flavour. We sit down with President Moon Jae-in to talk Trump, troublesome neighbours, and taking the time to watch TV with his cat, no less. Plus, we dedicate a 48-page survey to an in-depth look at South Korea through the chefs, artists, entrepreneurs, and designers shaping it. Elsewhere, we profile the key players searching for positive solutions in Jerusalem, meet the sharp minds making a point in the pencil industry, and augur the year ahead in art from New York, London, and Hong Kong. In the design pages, we mark the rise of timber towers from France to the US and bed down in the bedazzling dorms of a Copenhagen college that has us mulling over the merits of heading back to school. All before a breeze around the world's biggest outerwear fair, ISPO in Munich. And we chew over Paris's freshest new food shop. Monocle's March issue is out now and available on all good newsstands or by subscription.
And you're back with Midori House with me, Andrew Muller. Still with me are Quentin Peel and Brian Klass. As we go to air, US President Donald Trump has not rescinded his plan to impose stiff tariffs on imported steels, and nor, despite the fact that he made the promise several whole days ago, does he appear to have forgotten about it. It therefore has to be assumed that he's serious, although the EU's interesting list of suggestions of targets for retaliatory tariffs on American products, Levi's jeans, Harley-Davidson motorcycles, and American bourbons, suggests a certain whimsy on this side of the Atlantic for the moment, at least. Brian, he said he would do it, in fairness, and this is one of those things where his supporters said, well, he's just keeping his promises. But does it strike you that there is any, if I can try to put you in Donald Trump's shoes here for the moment, is there any strategy to this beyond his fairly familiar one of more or less reflexively just stirring up conflict for the sake of it?
Yeah, I think there is, actually. And I think there's two angles to this. One is the sort of idea of the campaign promise of being an economic populist and economic nationalist. And for his base, a lot of people are excited about this. The second is that there's a Pennsylvania special election next week in the heart of sort of what would be, the manufacturing areas that turned to Trump in the 2016 election, the sort of disaffected middle America. And this could be a ploy to sort of shore up support for a embattled Republican in a seat that should not be embattled. I would also add that it's not the European response with bourbon and Harley-Davidson motorcycles is not really about whimsy. It's strategic, and it's very smart, because Harley-Davidson is headquartered in Wisconsin, where Paul Ryan represents the Speaker of the House, and Kentucky bourbon is Mitch McConnell's hometown, right? So so we're talking about a strategy that's aimed at taking these people and putting them on the spot and understanding that's going to affect their industries. And that's why Paul Ryan this morning sent out a fundraising email that linked to a CNBC story talking about how the stock market was plunging as a result of these tariff ideas. So again, it's a question of how much the Republicans will give when everybody knows the truth, which is they do not like Trump, they do not like his ideas, and yet they're willing to go to bat for him. Is this the breaking point? We're going to find out.
But just to follow that up, Brian, I have asked you personally the question, is this the breaking point, at least 200 times
yep.
in the last 2 years. I have been keeping count. But obviously this idea is total anathema to the Paul Ryan free yep. trader wing of the Republican Party, isn't it?
It's exactly,
they would regard this as yep. insanity.
It is exactly the opposite of why Paul Ryan got into politics. I mean, these people got into politics, the people who are now in charge of Congress, a lot of them grew up during the sort of Reagan era, that he was their hero, right? And the sort of idea of free markets and freedom stands against everything that Trump stands for. Trump over the weekend praised President Xi for a power grab at the same time he's imposing tariffs. I mean, he's talking about consolidating power for a communist autocrat at the same time he's imposing tariffs on our own allies. It is exactly the antithesis of everything Paul Ryan purported to stand for his entire life. And now the question is, he has real power. Is he going to use it?
Quentin, these retaliatory sanctions being suggested by the EU, as Brian points out, are strategic as well as undeniably amusing. But how ugly potentially could a trade war between the US and the EU get?
Well, it's the sort of thing that you can slip into alarmingly quickly. I think that everybody says, look, this isn't a trade war yet. This is just people sounding off. And, yes, OK, he'll go ahead and slap these tariffs on and then the EU will retaliate and then they'll sort of sort things out. Because after all, as you were implying earlier, Donald Trump is very short-termist in his policies. And this could be just about an election and also about a very difficult week in the White House last week. He needed a distraction. But nonetheless, it is an extraordinary moment where his closest, I mean, he's putting pressure here, of course, on Canada and Mexico, as well as on the European Union. The one country he doesn't really seem to be putting much pressure on is the one he claims to be, which is China. I mean, only 2% of US steel imports come from China. It's tiny compared with Canada, Korea and Germany.
Brian, this question I'm asking with the rider that I understand even less about international trade than President Trump does, but it is a fact that the US does import four times more steel than it exports. Is there possibly a level at which this does make sense, the idea of trying to protect the US steel industry?
No, in a short answer. And the reason for that is because if you look at pure jobs in the U.S., there are over 6 million people employed in industries that use steel. There are about 125,000 in industries that produce steel. The U.S. is not going to have its future in raw production. It's incredibly idiotic to go and try to revive sort of, 19th century protectionism to protect industries that, frankly, the U.S. is not going to be good at for the 21st century. We should focus on the industries of the future, the things that the U.S. actually has a competitive edge on. And on top of this, one thing that I think we need to think about in geopolitics is this is also another layer of the Russia arguments in the U.S. It will become this because Putin has wanted to drive a wedge between Europe and the United States for decades. all of a sudden, Trump is now creating a trade war between its closest Western allies and not actually punishing groups like China and Russia. China is like the 11th largest source of U.S. steel. You know, Canada, and we've got Canada, South Korea, the EU, et cetera. It's hurting U.S. allies. It's creating a real rift in geopolitics while it's also shooting America in its own foot economically.
Okay, well, finally tonight, a common feature of countries which have a state broadcaster is a ceaseless chorus of tedious whining from that coterie of every society which appears genuinely outraged that not every last penny of their taxes is spent strictly in accordance with their own personal preferences. Hurrah, then, for the people of Switzerland who voted this weekend in a referendum on abolishing the license fee for the Swiss Broadcasting Corporation. Fully 71% of voters were against the initiative. Quentin, you are a citizen of the country whose state broadcaster is pretty much the model for all of them, the BBC. And increasingly in recent years, there's a lot of whining and moaning about the licence fee, which we should point out is compulsory and so forth. And not paying it is, you know, can attract criminal sanction. But why do state broadcasters attract such resentment? Is it just the fact that you have to pay for them?
I think that's part of it. I think it's also that there are some pretty substantial commercial figures out there who have a real interest in knocking them. So in the United Kingdom...
Certainly the case in the UK.
Yeah, absolutely. This is Mr. Murdoch and all his papers who keep banging away on how it's iniquitous that we should have the BBC. I think that they also... funnily enough, though, inspire remarkable loyalty. And that's, fun enough, what we've seen in Switzerland. And I think it would happen here, too. I mean, I know that there is, of course, a whole new generation who watch Netflix, who don't get their news from the BBC. But when you look at some of those extraordinary programmes, like David Attenborough's nature programmes and the civilizations we're seeing at the moment and so on, those are the sort of things that a state broadcaster is prepared to invest in, along with looking after minority languages. That was another issue in Switzerland.
There is an extraordinary solipsism to this argument, though, isn't there, Brian? Or at least it strikes me as this. I mean, I am sure that myself personally, as a light BBC licence payer, I'm sure 98% of what the BBC broadcasts is of absolutely no interest to me whatsoever. But I don't assume that it should be. I'm not the only person who pays their licence.
I think this is one of the reasons why state broadcasters get fire from a vocal minority, right? And they are very vocal in sort of raging against the broadcaster from the left and from the right, is that we have an increasingly polarized society and people expect that their media will now cater to them because everybody else is consuming from this menu of media options, right? You go to Facebook, you can click on whatever you like, you can listen to whatever radio station you like this one. You can go on TV and watch the different program that depending on your political bent, and also with newspapers, right, where you can buy whatever you like. And so all of a sudden there's one that's trying to do the impossible thing, which is somehow pleasing everyone. And you have a variety of people who say, oh, it's not pleasing me and I'm upset about this. The majority of people in the country understand that its mission is important. The news cycle and the news production that it creates is worth the fact that you may be upset about the content of a sitcom or whatever that you don't like. And I think that that's what you see in the Switzerland referendum.
Quentin, do we then confront a paradox that as the media landscape becomes more variegated and more diffuse, the sort of central pillar state broadcaster actually becomes more important, not less?
You could certainly argue that. I think their role is going to shrink. I have no doubt about that. I wouldn't be surprised if we all end up with a sort of much more like public broadcasting system as one has in the United States, rather than the great giant that is the BBC here. And also, I mean, the BBC, when it costs about £150 in Britain, Swiss broadcasting was costing €450 for everybody. That's rather a lot of money. So I think they need to be a bit more modest.
Everything, in fairness, in Switzerland costs rather a lot of money. I don't think you get much change for a cup of coffee out of that kind of cash these days. But that does bring us to the end of today's show. Brian Klass and Quentin Peel, thank you both very much for joining us. The show was produced by Carlotta Ribello, researched by Daphne Karnesis, Amber Roberts and Pierre-Antoine Denis. Our studio manager was Christy Evans. Music next at 1900, it's Culture with Rob Bound. We'll have more on the day's main stories on the Daily at 2200. Midori House returns at the same time tomorrow, 1800 London time. I'm Andrew Muller. Thanks for listening. Goodbye.